A new governor takes power in Florida. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Ron DeSantis is officially the governor of Florida. Today we're going to talk about the inauguration festivities. We'll also look at one of the big decisions DeSantis is expected to make this week, picking new justices for the Florida Supreme Court. How will the state's highest court shift in the coming year? Also, the partial government shutdown could be compromising safety at the airports. Some of the people charged with inspecting planes are on furlough. We'll discuss the story plus concerns over safety on cruise ships. And the 2019 Miami Jewish Film Festival launches this week. We're going to meet the producer of a film called My Survivor, a documentary about how survivors are sharing their stories with younger generations.
The future is for them, that it should never happen again.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Today, 1.5 million more Floridians have jobs, and our economy is one of the best in the nation.
The shift of power in Florida is official. Ron DeSantis was sworn in today as Florida's newest governor, continuing two decades of Republican leadership in the state capitol. In his inauguration speech, DeSantis focused on his plans to combat the blue-green algae crisis in the state and, of course, continue economic growth. WFSU reporter Ryan Daly has been following all the inauguration festivities this week, and he joins us from the studios in Tallahassee. Ryan, a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Hi, Luis. Thanks for having me on.
So Governor DeSantis pledged to take major action on the environment in his first weeks in office. I mean, to what extent did we hear that message today?
Yeah, I mean, you heard some of the familiar things you've heard DeSantis talk about on the campaign trail as well, protecting natural resources and water quality. And like he tends to do, he spoke about it mostly in economic terms, its effect on tourism and Floridians' property values, but also just our general quality of life. And I believe he called it the smart thing to do and the right thing to do to attack some of these things pretty aggressively. He talked about efforts to save waterways, like you said, fighting the toxic blue-green algae and discharges from Lake Okeechobee. He says in a gaggle yesterday, in a press gaggle, he said he will be debuting his new environmental platform in the days after his inauguration. And one thing that's interesting, I think, that he said is regarding some of these potential environmental policies he's planning to roll out. He says it's something that doesn't fall neatly on party lines. He indicated that he thinks some people from across the aisle are really going to like his environmental angle that he's going to take. And he didn't get into too many specifics yesterday, but he said he's looking forward to doing something that's not just a red versus blue issue.
And then what about the focus on the state's economic growth? What was he talking about with that?
Right. On expanding Florida's economy, I think DeSantis has pushed hard to position himself as the anti-tax governor. At the same time, you heard in his speech today during the inauguration that he praises the state's history when it comes to taxes. And in his speech, he touted the favorable tax climate we have here. But, he's promised on the campaign trail to veto anything that raises taxes in Florida, but especially those that apply to businesses. The idea there being to attract businesses to the state to grow our workforce. There's also been talk of expanding vocational programs in the state and investing in the state college system as it relates to education's impact on state workforce. But then you also hear some other things, like if you look at his economic transition team, they had a meeting in the last few weeks. They talked about smart infrastructure, as a system in which, we have that technology on the horizon for automated cars. And with smart infrastructure, you'd have a system where automated cars essentially can communicate with the infrastructure around them, as well as other self-driving vehicles. So, You know, I think they're taking a lot of different angles to trying to expand Florida's economy. But, yeah, I think that's something that you find is a real point of emphasis with his leadership style.
And I wanted to get a sense, too, of whether or not he's trying to distance himself from Governor Rick Scott or if he's going to continue a lot of the same conservative policies. This, again, coming from the inaugural speech. Let's listen.
I'm also fortunate to be succeeding our new U.S. Senator, Rick Scott, who stood here 8 years ago at a time of great economic turmoil and pledged to put people back to work.
So, I mean, yeah, do we get a sense that he's kind of going along the same lines as Rick Scott, or is he trying to push away from Scott and Scott's policies?
So, I mean, I think like in the soundbite we just heard, you're probably not going to hear him vocalize it. But I think if you look a little closer, maybe read between the lines a little bit, you will see points where he diverges from Scott in pretty significant ways. I mean, one of them is smokable medical marijuana, obviously, you know. So DeSantis was asked Monday if he plans to discontinue the state's appeal on allowing smokable medical marijuana. And he said he will be making an announcement within the first 2 weeks of taking office on that. He wasn't specific, but he said he is, quote, not committed to upholding the ban on smokable marijuana. You know, he said, and this is a direct quote, he said, "I think at the end of the day, when the people speak on these things, we want to implement their will. I don't think that's been done fully." And he called it a 72% issue, referring to the majority support for that. I mean, if you put that in contrast with, you know, that was one of Rick Scott's things, was appealing that, you know, allowing smokable marijuana in the state. I think you can see some of those, that a little bit of that divergence when you look at what DeSantis has said about the environment as well. On the campaign trail, he was asked about essentially climate change. He said, and this is a direct quote as well, he said, "I would say human activity contributes to changes in the environment. But then he says, I am not a global warming person. I don't want that label on me." So, you know, that while that might seem like kind of a tepid kind of dipping your toe into the water to recognizing climate change, it is a far cry from our former governor, Rick Scott, who, you know, famously banned some state employees from using terms like
right.
Global warming.
Again, talking with WFSU reporter Ryan Daly, he's been following the inaugural festivities in Tallahassee this week. Today, Ron DeSantis sworn in as Florida's newest governor, continuing 2 decades of Republican leadership in Tallahassee. State Senate President Bill Galvano discussed expansion of educational opportunities across the state this week. Let's take a listen real quick.
We need to have a nexus between what we are teaching our students and what the opportunity is that is out in the state. And at all levels, K-12, but especially in our technical colleges and in our state college system. I mean, these are the institutions that are part of the community, the ones that we had designed at the beginning to respond to workforce needs.
And by the way, this was a conversation. This was a speech during the Thought Leaders Luncheon on Monday. But Ryan, do you get the sense that does that appear to be on Governor DeSantis' agenda these first several months in Tallahassee?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this week has certainly not been the first mention of things like vocational programs and the state college system. I mean, I think the idea behind boosting those things is that at the local level, these technical colleges and technical centers are the places where, you know, that people are being trained for the jobs that are in their area. And I think a guy like Ron DeSantis, with his leadership style, and obviously you just heard from Bill Galvano, I think they find that valuable in boosting local economies. And then obviously you aggregate all those together, and that kind of is a bellwether for the health of Florida's economy as a whole. So I think you will definitely see those things expanded. I don't know if that means increased funding in this coming session or anything like that. I think it's early for specifics,
right.
But you will definitely see a push.
And real briefly, what else did you take away from that luncheon on Monday?
Well, you know, I think some of the more valuable, you know, just nuggets of information that came out of that were actually in the gaggle afterward with Ron DeSantis, you know, in which he said, you know, a number of different things. But he's really emphasizing his judicial appointments. In fact, his Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez said that that might be the most important thing that's going to happen to our state, I believe she said, in its history. So, you know, one point of emphasis he made there is that, you know, he does not want essentially what in a lot of circles is called judicial activism. He said that the judicial branch had been essentially usurping legislative power in recent years. And he says, you know, to quote him directly, I may be paraphrasing a bit, but he said he's going to put a stop to that tomorrow.
And that, of course, something that we'll be following when he makes that announcement, of course, in the weeks to come as, the shift. And that's something we're going to be talking about here in just a moment, is that shift in the Florida Supreme Court. Ryan Daly, again, reporter for WFSU, joining us from the studios in Tallahassee, covering the inaugural festivities today. Ryan, thanks so much, man.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And again, Ron DeSantis sworn in today as Florida's newest governor. Well, still to come, we're going to talk about some of the biggest choices that the new governor is going to be making, as in putting in three new justices in the Florida Supreme Court. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, as Governor Ron DeSantis steps into office, one of his first expected actions is to nominate a new justice to the Florida Supreme Court. There are three vacancies coming up that need to be filled by his administration, which will likely shift the court significantly more conservative. So what impact could the shift in the court have on issues like stand your ground, school choice, clean water, medical malpractice, and many, many more? We're joined now by Travis Randolph. He's a partner with Cole, Scott, and Kassane. He recently wrote a piece in the Florida Phoenix about the process of nominating judges to the state's Supreme Court. Travis, it's such a pleasure. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you for having me.
So how has the process for nominating Supreme Court justices in Florida changed over the last couple of decades? I think it's important to point that out.
Well, right now the process as it stands is that there are candidates who are nominated by the Judicial Nominating Committee, and those candidates are submitted to the governor for him to choose the candidate that he thinks is more appropriate for the Supreme Court. The nominating process is one that has a lot of, mystery if you don't understand the process. I mean, the people who are qualified, they apply for the position, they go through the application process, and which means they have to be interviewed by the nominating committee, and they, out of the people who interview, they pick a few names to send to the governor, and that is whom the governor picks to make his selection for the Supreme Court.
So the governor really has a lot of power and influence over who's going to be on that bench.
Yes, it does. And, you know, the reflection of the bench is more at this point a reflection of who's in office rather than the population of Florida, which we consider is kind of troubling.
And that, of course, you know, with that power, that, of course, has really made this process significantly more politicized.
Well, I mean, I believe that statements by Governor DeSantis yesterday points this out. One of the things that were stated was his, his opinion that the Florida Supreme Court has become a body that has overreached, is the sense that he was saying out. And his nominations that we can assume, based upon his statements, his nomination will be an attempt to curb what he sees as a judicial overreach, even though it is a separate and independent body of the government.
Again, one of the other interesting things about that, though, is this, and this goes even to like the U.S. Supreme Court, is that you could pick justices that may lean toward your party, but that doesn't always mean they're going to favor anything that you're doing, though, right?
Right, it does. But the people who do the nominations, they have an obligation, to send names to the governor whom they feel will reflect the community. Because as a community, we expect people who are making these kind of decisions to have the experience and reflect the community at large. And so when the process seems not to forward that, when it seems to be more of a political gamble, meaning that only people who will be nominated will be people who will assumed to be acceptable by the governor, then the process is flawed and needs to be corrected.
Well, what are some of the major cases that you can think of, even one in which rulings by the Florida Supreme Court had an outsized influence on the state politics?
Well, I think that coming up now, we see with the passage of Amendment 4, where we have the felony disenfranchisement process totally turned back to people being people who are eligible. As soon as they complete their sentence and did everything they need to do, then they're eligible to vote. Governor DeSantis has announced or put out his opinion that there needs to be some sort of intervention by the governor in order to halt that process or stall the process.
Because starting as of today,
yes, as of
people
today,
can start registering to vote.
Yes, and I mean, and the way that the amendment was written and the way that the amendment was passed, it is a self-executing amendment. And so according to the amendment, it should be something that goes into effect today. Anyone who's eligible should be able to vote. However, Governor DeSantis has stated that he believes that there should be some sort of halt in the process and procedure. And, you know, it's troubling. It is.
It appears for the first time in nearly four decades that there will not be an African-American represented on the state Supreme Court based upon the judges chosen from the Judicial Nominating Commission. What concerns does that raise for you as it relates to the rulings on criminal justice, education? I mean, anything, really, we can go through the line.
Right. And, you know, our concern is that there is no diversity on the Florida Supreme Court. These issues affect all of the state of Florida. Each and every citizen is potentially affected by a ruling that's made by the Florida Supreme Court. And so we want the bench to be able to understand the community in which it represents. People in the community want to feel that the Florida Supreme Court actually represents them and their interests and can take into account the diversity of the state, can take into account the different cultural diversities within a state. Florida is one of the most diverse states in the union, and we feel that the Florida Supreme Court should reflect that when they're making their rules and when they're making their decisions that affect the everyday lives of Florida citizens. Right now, we have nominees sent to the governor, and of those nominees, not one is African American. And so, you know, we feel that this is troubling. However, it is not the end game. The governor could say, you've sent me these names, I don't agree with them, I'm going to send you back through the process, and you bring me more people who are actually reflective of the state of Florida. And he can do that. Or he can choose from the names that have been given to him, and we won't have an African American sitting on the Florida Supreme Court.
Again, I'm talking with Travis Randolph. He's a partner at the law firm CSK Legal in Miami. Randolph recently authored a piece in the Florida Phoenix detailing his concerns with a process for nominating judges to the Florida Supreme Court. Governor DeSantis is expected to announce new appointees to the Florida Supreme Court starting tomorrow. This, of course, we'll be following that story as it goes. What do we know, and you mentioned Amendment 4, but what do we know about other cases maybe that are coming up for the court that these new appointees could have a big bearing on?
Well, we know that medical marijuana has been in the news lately, and we know that that is an issue that is going to affect many in our community who are minorities within the community, whether it's access to medicinal marijuana, whether or not it's legal, whether or not it's available. And this is a decision that could be decided or at least taken up by the Florida Supreme Court. And so to have the possibility of a Florida Supreme Court that does not understand the diversity and the diverse needs of the people of Florida is something that we will keep an eye on as well. Climate change, I don't know if the current administration will allow that to be a topic this coming season, but climate change is something we have to deal with. And so if there is an issue in which the state legislature has to deal with, whether or not there are going to be laws that affect climate change and combating climate change, this is something that we want to have a Supreme Court that will be able to understand the various, commitments and the various challenges of coastal cities in dealing with this issue. And if we are not having a Supreme Court that is open to the idea that this is something that's real and something that needs to be addressed, then those decisions are going to reflect that, and we'll never get on top of this issue.
Let's go back to something you said a little bit ago. As you mentioned, the governor believes, he has stated, we've played the clip, that the Florida Supreme Court has too much power and that it has influenced too much in government, and he wants to reduce that. But what exactly would that entail? I mean, do you think that he is genuinely trying to, curb what the Supreme Court has been doing, or that he just wants to lean it more toward his side?
Well, you know, The fact that that statement is made is troubling because it hints that there is a political motivation behind the appointments themselves. And this is an independent branch of the government that we feel should have its own autonomy to do what it feels is right without any type of political pressure. And if he puts out a statement like that, then the nominating committee may be inclined to only submit names for potential justices that they feel would be in line with his mode of thinking on these issues. And so that usurps the whole process because you take the neutrality out of the nominees. And instead of having people whom we feel would be a good jurist, we have people who we feel would be more in line with the political goals of the governor.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of to continue on that line is what do you think is that fair process? What should we be considering when it comes to picking the people who should sit on that bench?
Well, I think that we should look at, number one, the qualifications of the people who are applying. We had 59 applicants for this last nominating process. And of those, we had 6 African-Americans, we had 10 women, and we have 4 Hispanics. And of that, we have no African-Americans submitted for approval by the governor. And so we should look to see, okay, we have qualified people. What are the other factors that we should be looking at? Diversity, representation of the state as a whole, someone who can relate to the issues that are going to be experienced by the citizens of the state of Florida.
Does the governor, do you think the governor has to play a role in any way, shape, or form, or do you want to take that out of his hands?
Well, the governor has a duty to appoint. A power that he has, and we don't want to take that out. But we think that he should be mindful of the fact, or at least make an effort to include diversity within his judicial appointments.
And there have been legislative proposals to change this process.
There have been, but right now we have to deal with what's in front of us. And right now our hopes lie in that the governor will take our concerns seriously and will actually make an effort to increase diversity on the bench.
Do you get a sense that, I know he just took office today, but do you get the sense that he's listening or that he's open to hearing any of these concerns?
Well, what we've been trying to do, or what we've been trying to do, is put the word out that this is the genuine concern of, you know, the citizens of the state of Florida. The governor has stated that he is open to listening to, you know, people on both sides of the aisles and people on both sides of the bench. So we are hopeful. However, you know, given the statements that we've heard, we're mindful of the fact that our hopes may not be realized. At this point, we can just wait and see.
Travis Randolph, again, he's a partner with Cole Scott and Kassane. He recently wrote a piece in Florida Phoenix about, again, this process of nominating judges to the state Supreme Court. We are expected to hear from the newly elected Governor Ron DeSantis on his first decision on one of those 3 positions that have to be filled. Travis, it's been a pleasure, man. Thank you so much for the time today. All right, still to come, how is the government shutdown impacting airline safety? We're going to take a look at that coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, tonight, President Donald Trump will deliver an Oval Office address about what he calls a crisis at the U.S. and Mexico border and will once again demand a border wall. We will carry NPR's live coverage beginning at 9 p.m. tonight. The $5 billion in funding for the border wall started a partial government shutdown, and it's now on day 18. That means many federal workers are going on their third week without a paycheck. And as Miami Herald tourism reporter Taylor Dolman has found, this is probably putting you, who is traveling by airline, at risk. Dolman looked at one of the sectors impacted by the shutdown, the safety of an aircraft, and she's joining us now from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald. Taylor, such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Since the government shutdown, what safety concerns regarding air travel have you been looking at? What should we be looking at?
So I was at Miami International Airport last week talking to Federal Aviation Administration safety inspectors who, as you mentioned, haven't been working since December 21st. They're really concerned that some of the mistakes that they normally correct while on the job will go uncorrected since they aren't working. And that could be making air travel more unsafe for passengers.
And just remind us real quickly of what an aviation inspector does.
Mm-hmm. An aviation inspector is in charge of making sure airlines are complying with all FAA safety regulations. So that means they investigate aircraft accidents, they oversee repairs of planes, and they also monitor pilot and flight attendant work. So one example of a mistake that an inspector might catch while on the job, one inspector I spoke to said that during the month before the shutdown, he alerted two different airlines to potentially dangerous situations in which fuel was being leaked while a plane was refueling with passengers on board. Another example, another inspector told me he was in charge of investigating a collision that happened actually on the day before the shutdown between two cargo planes at MIA. He's supposed to verify that the airlines made the correct repairs to those planes, but he can't because he's not working. And so those planes are now back in the air without his verification.
So let's be clear here. Are airplanes getting their full safety checks or not?
Yes. So airplanes are being checked and maintained by the airlines. And it's also important to note that FAA safety inspectors don't have the capacity, even when they're on the job, to check every plane. But they stress that as the shutdown drags on, that just means less and less oversight of airline operations. And they say that that's putting passengers at risk.
And in your article, you wrote that safety inspectors are considered, quote, non-essential workers. Help me understand what that means.
So that's right. The FAA has designated safety inspectors as non-essential, meaning they can be furloughed during shutdowns. And they have been furloughed in shutdowns since, I think, 2013. In the past, Congress has passed legislation to pay them back for their time off once the shutdown is over. But every inspector I spoke to said they'd prefer to be working even without pay, which is what their TSA colleagues are doing, than be sitting this out.
Now, you've reached out and you talked to the Federal Aviation Administration. What have they said about addressing this problem?
I wasn't actually able to speak to anyone on the phone. Their staff is very slimmed, as you can imagine, during this time. But in a statement, they said that the U.S. airspace is safe and that they're limiting FAA investigations of crashes to ones with significant casualties.
I'm talking with Miami Herald tourism reporter Taylor Dolvin. She's been reporting on the impact on airports due to the partial federal shutdown. Now, I want to switch things over to another story that she's been covering, which has to do with cruise ships and the cruise ship industry. Since November, a number of passengers have gone overboard on cruises. Now, we've asked our listeners on Facebook and Twitter if they've taken a cruise recently, and if so, what forms of safety precautions or training were they given during their cruise? We heard from one, Megan Koch from Boca Raton. She says that she took a Royal Caribbean cruise this past November. She said, quote, their goal is definitely preventing the spread of diseases, understandably. Safety session was focused on getting to our assigned spots in the event of an emergency. I can't remember being spoken to about safe behavior on open decks, end quote. So, Taylor, what's the protocol for cruise lines, when it comes to this issue of people going overboard?
Every cruise line is different, but it's my understanding that each ship has its own man overboard checklist that they follow. And this includes things like alerting the captain, switching to manual steering to turn the ship around, preparing a stretcher when someone's rescued, and lowering rescue boats into the water.
What's the problem with the protocol, though?
So the protocol is pretty standard, but it's not always followed. Royal Caribbean's man overboard checklist was uncovered in a trial last month in which the family of a 22-year-old man who died in an overboard incident last year sued the cruise line. At the top of the checklist, it says release life buoys with smoke signal and light and scan for the person. And this first step in the checklist wasn't followed. There's also the common issue of a cruise ship not being aware that someone has actually gone overboard until hours later, after it's really not possible to turn the ship around and search.
What do we know about the reasons why people go overboard? Are they mostly accidental?
So it's difficult to determine why exactly someone goes overboard. Sometimes they are suicides, other times they are falls or pushes. And sometimes the incidents aren't captured on security cameras, which makes determining the reason really difficult.
And of the people who've gone overboard in the past year, how many get rescued?
So none of the five people, two crew members and three passengers who've gone overboard since the end of November of last year have been rescued. In all, 23 people went overboard a cruise ship in 2018, and only three were rescued. It's important to note, though, that nearly 30 million people cruised last year. So that makes the chances of someone going overboard very slim.
And there was a law that was implemented in 2010 to address some of these concerns. But real quickly, what is that law and is it working?
The law is called the Cruise Vessel Security and Safety Act of 2010, and it was meant to improve safety for passengers and crew on board cruise ships. It requires ships to use, and this is the exact language, technology that can be used for capturing images of passengers or detecting passengers who've fallen overboard to the extent that such technology is available. And it's the cruise industry's position that the detection technology on the market doesn't work very well, and so it's therefore not available. Only a handful of cruise ships in the world have it. A law that could close the loophole and require cruise ships to have both things, both video recording and automatic detection technology, has been proposed in Congress twice since 2010, but it hasn't been passed.
Well, again, as you said, there are millions of people who take cruises every year, and so the number of people who are actually going overboard is a very small number, but when you look at it another way, it's almost two per month, and you have to wonder, you know, what more can cruise lines do to protect passengers? We also have to know too that there was a case last year, and the court actually ruled in favor of the cruise line. The widower of a woman who went over sued a cruise line, but the court went in favor of the cruise line industry in that case. Again, talking about safety on cruise lines, talking with the tourism reporter for the Miami Herald, Taylor Dolvin. Taylor, joining us from the studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. Taylor, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
And again, you can find out more about this story at WLRN.org. We also, again, heard from another listener who told us about their experience on the cruise. This from at ZZMama1 on Twitter. She said, took a Norwegian Cruise Line summer and a Royal Caribbean prior to that one. It's hard to see how anyone could accidentally go overboard. Safety briefings were mostly about how to get to the lifeboats in case of emergency. I didn't hear much about overboard precautions. Interesting to know that. All right, still to come, we're going to look at the 2019 Miami Jewish Film Festival, which launches this week. That's next, coming up on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the 2019 Miami Jewish Film Festival begins this week. The first films begin on Thursday. One of the films showing is My Survivor. It's a documentary of Holocaust survivors passing on their stories to younger generations. Let's take a listen.
Unfortunately, one day we're never going to have firsthand survivors. All we will have are secondhand, thirdhand, fourthhand accounts.
You see, the future is no longer us. The future is the second generation and the third generation.
Well, just a note, our reporter Katie Swatalski did a story about the curator for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, and you could go back and listen to that story and other coverage, again, about protecting that history. It's at WLRN.org. Joining us now is the executive producer for that film, My Survivor, Dr. Mindy Hirsch. Dr. Hirsch, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also joining us, executive director of the Miami Jewish Film Festival, Igor Sterenberg. Always a pleasure, Igor. How you
Nothing
doing?
Nothing but a thrill. This is great.
Igor, real quickly, as you always tell me, I mean, every year this festival just keeps growing. You know, tell us a little bit about what's special this year.
I think this year we've reached this year we've reached a certain peak in terms of our growth. We have more than 80 films that are going to be premiering, and this has become the largest program of any Jewish or Israeli film festival in the world.
And so that also means you're probably getting production companies from everywhere, more than before, who they want to be part of this. What's the process of picking them?
We vet over 2,000 film submissions that are from all over the world, and we have to narrow down to about 80. And for that very reason, we have more world premieres than we've ever had. We have 12 films that are going to be celebrating the world premiere at our festival. It's another record. And most importantly, the milestone that we're most inspired by and find most pride in is that we have 25 films directed by women, which will be celebrated at our festival, which is an unheard of figure. 32% of all films were either directed or produced or written by women. in our lineup.
And this movie that I want to focus on here, My Survivor, tell us a little bit about that.
I think this is one of the most powerful films in our program. It's incredibly timely as well. We're right now, as a Jewish community, facing the most anti-Semitism we've ever felt in so many years. And this is a film that speaks to the importance of legacy, importance of remembrance, importance of what we survived in terms of the tragedies and previous persecutions, and how that memory should positively impact the next generation in terms of how we relate with one another, should transcend walls, borders, boundaries, and create bridges.
Dr. Hirsch, I mean, going through one of the clips of this film, and we heard a little bit of it here at the beginning, it is this fascinating idea. You have this generation that is, you know, fading away, so that to protect that history, they have to share with younger generations. But where did the idea come from?
So the goal of the film, as we've already talked about, is to really answer the question, who will tell the stories when the last survivor is gone? The University of Miami had an amazing program that lasted for 11 years in which Holocaust survivors were matched with undergraduates, and they had the opportunity to form a really remarkable, intimate, intergenerational relationship spanning two semesters. The program ended in 2016 because we're coming to the end of the generation of survivors. I felt, and my role, I was the director of academic enrichment of the program. And as we came to the end, I felt that these students, by their own admission, had changed, that these relationships that they were now carrying forward within them were such that they wanted to confirm for the survivors that their stories and the memories that they imparted to the students would not be lost. And so
there was something so powerful I remember hearing from one of the survivors, is that, you know, what led to the Holocaust is this quietness.
Right.
And so, you know, I wondered, how do they feel from people you've talked to about where we are in today's world? And are they worried about quietness, or do they feel that, no, people are speaking up?
So certainly in the last couple of years of The Survivor, we saw the rise in global anti-Semitism, and the survivors were speaking about it at great length to their students. And when we began filming, we understood that that was going to be the context, one of the contexts that we were going to be addressing, the rise in hate crimes, anti-Semitism, Holocaust denial. And then, of course, 5 days before our first day of shooting, Charlottesville happened. And so what became a global concern over there became a very relevant concern over here. And then, of course, we saw not that much later Pittsburgh happened. So the students in the film talk about what they learned from their survivors and how they are interpreting what they understood about the Holocaust in light of what they themselves are now confronting, what their reality is moving forward.
And that's got to be something, as you're putting this film together, these things are, current events are happening.
Yes.
So it just seems to really bolster, you know, what that message is.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I also wanted to get a sense from you, too, as you talk to survivors, is these things continue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you think about what they lived through and these things continue today. What's going on with them? What are they thinking and feeling? And are they optimistic about the future or not?
I would not presume to speak for all survivors, but I can tell you that what I've heard from them is a fundamental sadness and a shift in the way they talk about the future, that they did not expect to turn on the television and watch Pittsburgh. They did not expect to see what's happening in Europe with the nationalistic governments that are coming to power. They're frightened. But they also believe they are an extraordinarily optimistic group, given that they went through one of the most horrific chapters in history. And they look to these young people, and you will meet seven of them in the film, who are committed to not only carrying their personal stories forward, but using the lessons of the Holocaust to understand and respond to hate and the rise of anti-Semitism.
And again, that film is called My Survivor, again, part of the this year's 2019 Miami Jewish Film Festival. Igor, just real briefly, just to switch things up a little bit, is, you know, you've got a lot of films to show. The ones for the opening night, Thursday, already sold out. But what? Just a quick highlight of some of the other stuff that you got going on.
We are always trying to open the festival to the entire wider Miami-Dade community. And so many of our events are going to be open and free to the public for inclusivity. We're showing Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, Under the Stars at the Soundscape. And in tribute
always
to,
a classic.
And in tribute to Howard Ashman, a legendary songwriter for Disney. You must know him from Little Mermaid, which he won the Academy Awards for, and Beauty and the Beast. We're showing Little Shop of Horrors, a treasure of his work. And then we're doing a documentary that's entirely about Howard Ashman as well. We're going to have his sister in attendance, as he passed away from AIDS, sadly. Other films that we're really excited about are Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck's Never Look Away, which unfortunately recently lost the Golden Globe, but at least it was nominated, which is amazing. And we have four other films that are nominated. They're going to be hopefully nominated for Academy Awards, and we're excited to be premiering.
So just a note real quickly is that we do have a link up on, we'll have it up on our Facebook and Twitter at WLRN Sundial, so you could see the list of movies, the calendar of events for this festival. Again, Igor Sterenberg, Executive Director of the Miami Jewish Film Festival. We also heard from Dr. Mindy Hirsch, Executive Producer of the film My Survivor, which is going to be playing during this festival. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time, guys. All right, that's the program for today. Tomorrow, again, coming up this week, we're going to continue our look into the... Oh, excuse me. Hold on a second. I jumped out quickly. That's my apologies. I ended this shorter than I thought.
We could still talk about movies.
We could keep talking. We're going to keep
Fantastic.
Talking. My apologies. I'm in another world at the moment. You know what, Igor? Real quickly, we were talking about, and you've been in here every year, and we're talking about the film festival and its growth and how, you know, you just continue to get more and more people who are applying to get their film in front of you. And I want to come back to this process of how you've got to choose through all these movies, like My Survivor. And what's the protocol? I mean, how do you decide, hey, this is a film that we definitely have to talk about? Or, you know what? I mean, that's a lot of movies you've got to say no to.
We don't play favorites. However much I love Dr. Mindy Hirsch, and that love is pure and true, had her film not really had the kind of powerful content that it has on screen, it would not be playing at our festival, because quality is the top priority whenever we choose anything to premiere. And we really are constantly looking at content that's going to leave an everlasting impression. It's the film that we cannot stop thinking about, talking about. And even if it's a film that I personally may not totally love, but it's the film that keeps me thinking, I really feel it's worthwhile to open it up to the rest of our community to discover. Because discovery is the thing that us as a platform, us as a festival, that is what is at stake in the work that we do. We want our greater Miami community to discover great cinema, great experiences, and great cultural lifestyles.
And by the way, something I want to touch on, you just said a little while ago too, is there's a big focus on female filmmakers for this upcoming festival. A lot of movies where women really had the bigger role in putting them together.
Yeah, we really believe that the festival needs to be an inclusive platform celebrating all the voices and amplify those voices through the richness of our program. This was not a conscious choice, and I really want all the listeners to understand. We didn't go out trying to purposely create a spotlight on women filmmakers this year. This was something after the fact when we did an overview of our entire lineup. We were like, oh my God, we really completely by chance have 25 films directed by women, and what an opportunity this is to shine this bright spotlight on them and give them this recognition. And what's even more inspiring is that, yes, we're doing this amazing spotlight, but it's really not window dressing. The community has come out to respond so positively. Half of those films are either sold out or near capacity as it is. It's really truly a message that all voices, all creative artists should be inspired to tell their personal stories and not feel in any way diminished or frightened. It should be an inspiration for people to pursue their dreams.
I know that, by the way, that could be a little bit, you know, for folks who see, if they go on your calendar, they may see that, oh, wait a second, this film is sold out. Is there any chance people might be able to see those films anyway?
We've rarely turned away a rush line, and a rush line is just patrons who weren't able to purchase advance tickets. They can still come out to the screening 5 minutes before showtime. We're going to do an overview of how many open seats there are, and any seats that are available, we always release. And 90% of the time, we always have seats to release.
And that's always been something good, too, is that you have made the effort to get people in to see the movies.
May I add that My Survivor has a second screening.
That's true.
Igor has done such a remarkable job shepherding us through this process. And on January 20th at 1 p.m. will be the second screening of My Survivor.
You know what? I wanted to ask you, Dr. Hirsch, about this. Is we've seen this shift, recently, and with the Me Too movement, to make sure that women in many different fields are getting that opportunity that they haven't been able to get. But in the film industry, what have you seen in that shift in making sure that those voices, because it is an important, there really is, if you watch a movie that's put together by a woman compared to a man, there's a very different perspective on how that film is done.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'm a novice filmmaker, I can tell you. This is my first
foray. Well, I'll tell you, for a first, that is amazing.
And by background, I'm actually a psychotherapist, so I have a lot of thoughts about what you asked, but not necessarily for now. Our executive producers group are all women, and we're all volunteers, and we're all committed to the concept. And our filmmaker is Jerry Levine, who is an accomplished documentary maker. And although not female, I would say he is also committed certainly to the project, and I think to the issues that you're talking about, a recognition that the field should be open.
And you know what? I mean, when you look at a film like this as well, I mean, I wanted to get a sense from you is, you know, the role that you play as an executive producer compared to what a director is doing. But I mean, how is that, how does that get coordinated? Who's making the final decisions on that?
Sure. So my title is senior executive producer. I also have a producing credit on the film, meaning that my sleeves have been rolled up and I have been involved in every aspect of this film from and certainly it's my relationships with the students that was the genesis for the film, and certainly that's true with the survivors as well. So it's really been a real partnership working with an exceptional filmmaker and bringing to him this idea.
And bring in the fact that you are a psychotherapist, and I'm wondering how that played a role in, again, here you're talking to multi-generations about this very big historical topic. How did that kind of come into how the storytelling was outlined and put together?
Mm-hmm. I think I have a lot of years of experience behind me. So it's a lens that colors everything. I'll also share with you that I myself am the child of Holocaust survivors. So I know this story and the imperative to tell this story from a lot of angles, and I understand that these young people, we had over 500 students who went through this program. We are highlighting 7. They are all ambassadors out there in the world, and I understand how seriously they take this role of carrying forward the lessons of the Holocaust. And when I can be helpful to them, and I do have that opportunity from time to time, I am.
I think I know what the answer would be to this, but I want your words, not mine, is what you hope people take away from My Survivor.
Mm-hmm. That we can always stand up to indifference. We can always stand up to hate. The world saw the most horrific genocide, the most unique genocide, occur 75 years ago, and we are still here today. And the opportunity is endless to make the world a better place.
And real quickly, Igor, let me come back over to you real quickly. I wanted to get a sense from you. Where do you see Jewish filmmaking going into the future? I mean, is it about retelling old stories, or is it about reshaping people's views of the Jewish community?
I think there are limitless opportunities in which storytellers can take that message. It's up to them in terms of how creative they want to approach it.
whether they want to revisit our past or whether they want to seek into the brightness of the future. What I want there to be an understanding of is that the Miami Jewish Film Festival is going to always be here to support their message. And we may not always agree with what they have to say, but we are going to be always there for them to shine that spotlight and to embrace their creativity.
The two movies coming out starting third, the festival starts on Thursday. The two movies, two different locations. Mm-hmm. What are they?
The Unorthodox, a laugh out loud, powerfully moving and beautiful underdog story called The Unorthodox. And the other film stars Felicity Jones and Armie Hammer in On the Basis of Sex, about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
That's the highly acclaimed movie right now about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And again, we'll have information on Facebook and Twitter about the schedule, so you can find out all the movies that are playing, when and where. And even though if you see sold out, Igor, as you said,
you're still welcome.
Don't give up. Don't give up. If you want to go see the movie, there's a chance you probably could still get in. All right. I've got my time right now this time. So as we finish up here, I want to just say you're hearing music of the Holocaust Survivors Band, a band formed by two survivors of the Holocaust right here in Miami. And we'll have a video of the New York Times documentary about their music on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Again, I want to thank Igor Scheirenberg, Executive Director of the Miami Jewish Film Festival. Starts on Thursday. Also, Dr. Mindy Hirsch, Executive Producer of the film My Survivor, which is going to get not one play, two plays during the festival. So please, if you have a chance, check it out. Dr. Hirsch, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Igor, always a pleasure, man. Thank you.
Thank you, Lewis.
I didn't sell you guys short. I got you the time. Thank you so much. I had one of those days. That is the program for today, this Tuesday, January 8th. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.